The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook if you sign up for a two-week trial of their service. Audible has 40,000 titles available to download. For all the details, follow the links at guardian.co.uk/audible.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky. We have a packed program for you this week, but before we dive in, I'd like first to welcome Jemima Kish, our fearless digital media correspondent, to the pod. Welcome, Jemima.
Hello.
I read on Twitter this morning that you spent the weekend dancing with wild abandon, according to somebody's Auntie Joyce.
It was a 60th birthday party and they played Nutbush City Limits and I couldn't contain myself. And it was the first time I've danced in about 2 years. That's what babies do to you.
Well, if only this was a video. Vod.
Alas, no video material exists.
Could you please audio describe what it was that you were doing? Because I'd like to hear what wild abandon.
Well, this was
like.
In Totnes, so there were lots of people freeing the spirit on the dance floor, and lots of people in more advanced years. And just having fun. And
I did pull
a muscle in my neck, but it was good. Yeah,
that's the
collar today. Yeah.
Well, we won't just be talking about Jemima's dance moves on this week's show. No, we will be discussing Minister Ed Vasey's apparent attack on net neutrality in a speech that he gave last week, and we will be hearing where good ideas come from. Joining Jemima and me in fierce debate is Tom Loosemore, former head of Channel 4's recently deceased Innovation Fund, 4IP. Welcome, Tom. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
In your high-vis tracksuit.
I do like a bit of lycra.
Well, again, if only this was a vodcast. And I don't have my camera today, so I can't take a picture. You're lucky. Now, Tom, tell me, what were your two technology highlights this year?
I think the main technology highlight was not being allowed to use a keyboard by my doctor for 4 months, which was a joy. I recommend it to anyone.
How on earth did you interact with technology?
I didn't. And again, I think that has a lot to recommend it. It's taking a little bit of a break, step back a bit, and gradually reintroduced a touchscreen, which has its pluses and minuses. And my highlight really, though, is discovering that speech recognition, particularly on Android, has kind of just crossed the threshold where you can kind of just use it. And I am loving the speech recognition on my Android phone right now. It just kind of works. And it means I don't have to use my hands, which is always a joy.
Well, pod listeners, if you agree with Tom, or in fact disagree, or have a few tech highlights that you think are more deserving, then do let us know. We'll be recording our end-of-year highlights program in a couple of weeks, and we want your say. All the links are on guardian.co.uk/techweekly. And in the meantime, keep listening to the next 30 minutes with The Guardian. We'll start with this week's news. Last week, the Minister for Culture, Ed Vasey, gave a controversial speech titled The Open Internet at a conference organised by the Financial Times. In the talk, he outlined steps for internet regulation that many have felt undermine its neutrality, laying out plans for a system in which ISPs can give preferential treatment to customers who pay. Now, this would have implications for content creators, everyone from a small startup to the BBC, because a future internet would be funded by the people who want to get information out there. Now, in the key passage, he said, consumers should always have the ability to access any legal content or service. Content and service providers should have the ability to innovate and, most importantly, to reach end users. This could include the evolution of a two-sided market where consumers and content providers could choose to pay for differing levels of quality of service. Jemima, what else did he say?
Well, this is one of these classic ministerial speeches where they have to try and get everyone on board. So it's quite cleverly written. But it's also a little bit misleading because people immediately thought, oh, well, he is advocating having a tiered internet system. To which he then responded and said, no, absolutely not. No, that's not what I said. No, me and Berners-Lee, you know, we're like that. We totally get it. Berners-Lee said that's very much not the case. So nobody really knows what he thinks now. It's just very muddy.
Tom, what are the most recent developments since this speech? What actually is happening with this case?
Well, I mean, the truth is that not a lot is happening in the UK right now. It's a little bit of a phony war, but, you know, phony wars are important. I mean, Vasey, to give him a bit of credit, he really addressed the issue head-on in quite a lot of detail in the speech. And I'd recommend you read it. It's a good speech. It really outlines the detail of net neutrality. And I think he did have a bit of a point that many commentators just knee-jerk responded to what they thought that the speech had actually said. I don't think Berners-Lee did. I think Berners-Lee read it in quite a lot of detail. And I'm with Jemima. I think the minister wanted both his cake and he wanted to eat it. He laid out some very clear groundwork around how important it is for the internet to remain open to all comers, how important it is that consumers understand what quality of internet service they're getting, what they're doing. Then he also went on to say that he would like to see service providers innovating with different models, whereby there's two-sided market they can pay. Now, the moment you're into sort of two-sided markets, that's kind of Ofcom speak for not just the people consuming content on the internet paying, but content providers too. It's not the internet anymore. It's basically a cable network layered on top of the internet, and that effectively means that the future of the internet will be slower development in this country than if ISPs really just focused on providing proper, pure internet access.
This opens up a whole bunch of questions, not least of which is something that we were debating in the office earlier. Would you say, Tom, that as Berners-Lee argues, that the internet is a public service, or would you say that it's a public utility? Because there is a distinction there.
Oh, I think that's sort of semantically sort of dancing on the head of a pin, to be honest. I mean, I think the one thing Vasey did get absolutely right, which is that we're not in a bad place in this country relative to other countries around net neutrality being a potentially disastrous issue, because we do have, relatively speaking, quite decent competition between internet service providers in this country. And the truth of the matter is that history teaches us, at least the last 20 years of history, that the openness, the innovation, the openness of the internet leads to greater innovation. People want it more than closed, pseudo-closed networks such as AOL, CompuServe, or cable. And you can go to an ISP that will offer you pure internet. That's not the case in the States, where you have monopoly. And that's not the case in many other countries as well, where you literally only have one provider of internet access to choose from.
But the US is a prime example of the innovation that comes out of the internet, yet you're suggesting that it is less neutral.
Oh, I think it's far less neutral. If you look at the choice you have as a consumer in the States around internet access, you're very constrained in many geographic regions in the States to typically just your cable provider or one telco. In the UK, we do have, relatively speaking, I'm being quite cautious here, because you know, we really do have four ISPs that kind of dominate the market. There's another two also-rans and the rest are tiddlers. And that's not as competitive as it could or maybe should be as a marketplace between ISPs. But and crucially, the ISPs in this country have really fought only on one dimension, and that's price. They really haven't bothered too much around the quality of service. And that aspect in Vasey's speech that I really support, and I think is really healthy, is his commitment to transparency about exactly what consumers get when they get internet access. What does that mean? Ofcom, for example, they commissioned some research a year ago about, in detail, real-life quality of internet connection do you get in the real world, not headline up to 24 megabit figures, but what do you really get? For some reasons, the detailed results of that didn't get published, only the headline numbers. Now, consumers, I would argue, need exact data about what kind of internet access they're getting, what quality, etc.
It's a really difficult issue to get consumers interested in as well, because it just sounds like another piece of jargon. And the people who defend the principle of net neutrality in this country use the example of the BBC, which accounts for a big chunk of data uses, or so the ISPs want us to focus on. And so, you know, perhaps the future would see the BBC paying to have to deliver its services, which would take a big chunk out of the BBC's budget. But beyond that, look at individual web publishers, even people trying to publish to their own personal websites and things. And the implications of a tiered internet are quite profound. And I think we need to translate this issue into what it means on a real practical level for individual people.
I think, though, this is very much a theoretical argument. I haven't yet seen evidence, Jemima, that a more neutral internet is fosters greater innovation. Given, you know, as you were saying, Tom, that the US is less neutral, yet there is so much innovation that comes out of the US in terms of digital content. What evidence is there actually that that a neutral internet will foster innovation.
Well, I was looking at some data from Three a while ago about usage of broadband from people on their mobile internet service. And I was trying to ask them how, you know, why are they gathering this research, basically? And this is just a spin-off of data that they have to gather because they're traffic shaping. So if they know that the majority of their users are spending, you know, half their data goes on Facebook, for example, and another third on Zynga, do they prioritise traffic to Facebook because it's so popular? And if they do, what's the flip side to that? Who's being penalised? So they are already traffic shaping, and that is the foundation for a tiered internet.
As Tim Berners-Lee says, Tom, the web is a public service, right? But the public service needs to be funded in some way. And so ultimately, how should it be funded? At the moment, it's a commercial priority. Should government, you know, not pour cash in? How should it be funded? Because it costs a whole bunch of stuff. It costs money to run the internet.
I mean, that's a fairly political question, and I would argue it's the last thing the government should do now is to subsidise the internet. I mean, it subsidised it in its early days, in the R&D days in universities. Kind of job done. I would leave it at that. I don't think there's a problem with how the internet is funded. I think it's really simple. I think if you consume bandwidth, either taking bandwidth out of the internet or putting bandwidth in terms of serving content, you pay for that bandwidth. The difficulties ISPs have got into in this UK is they've had a race for the bottom around unlimited internet access based on price, and have delivered a really simple message to consumers for many years now, is that you can have as much as you want for a fixed price. That doesn't work as people start to consume more and more internet. I think the answer is actually consumers paying... Well, they do already in some cases, but for the bandwidth they do actually consume in one way or another. And the answer to your other question about evidence of net neutrality being damaging, of non-net neutrality being damaging, just look at the competition that happened in the 90s between a closed network, a non-neutral network like AOL, like CompuServe, like the first version of MSN. They got absolutely destroyed by the internet. Now, Vasey makes this argument, you know, if the internet's better, it should win. The downside is, if he, in his speech, as he seems to, actively encourages ISPs to invest their scarce capital on having another go, and he's actively encouraging and shaping a market here, having another go at building the next tier of the internet, not to be the internet, you can't have a tiered internet, the internet is non-tiered, that's its definition, then they're not investing that money on open internet access being speeded up. They're investing it on having another go at a closed network. And I don't think ministers should be trying to shape the market like that, personally, when history teaches us that the open internet has beaten all comers thus far.
Well, for more information on the implications of a non-neutral internet, check out Tech Weekly's feature from the 25th of August. The links are on guardian.co.uk/techweekly. And speaking of a closed system, internet phenomenon Facebook has unveiled its latest killer app, Facebook Messages, a new service that, it's mooted, could destroy email. The new Messages tries to integrate all personal communication on the social network, including instant messaging and email, so conversations are easy to handle and in one place. They've also implemented a priority service that digs out the communication that users feel is most important to them. Now, Jemima, we acknowledged on the program recently that email is broken, so this is a good thing, isn't it? This is somebody curating our content for us.
It's good they're having a go, and frankly, Facebook email was so bad that anything's an improvement. I like the principle of taking all of these things, chat and text and email, and putting them in one place. But even with Facebook's skill in refining a process and with their interface design, I'm not convinced that it's going to be really good and really attractive and usable for quite a long time. And they are having teething problems as well.
Is this to do with the technology that they're using? What type of tech? How does it actually work?
Well, I don't think the filters that refine this messaging system are quite there yet. So basic stuff like you know, the sort of spammy group emails and texts you get, or a friend request from somebody you knew ages ago, it comes is prioritised as something that comes through on your mobile phone as an SMS. That, you know, that's not right, and you shouldn't have to go and fiddle around with the settings to get that set up properly.
Tom, I did sort of disparagingly describe Facebook as a closed system, as a walled garden, and I was wondering about your thoughts on this. What are the implications if indeed Facebook is a closed system, which many argue it is, because you have to have password, and it's, you know, they are trying to create a browser or a browsing web experience within the Facebook property. What are the implications for other email services? What are the implications for light internet users' use of the web if increasingly all of our attention is being focused into the Facebook property?
Well, first, I think I can see why Facebook have done this. I think they have realised that they have yet another opportunity to make more of the existing attention that they already aggregate within their walls. So I don't blame them for having a go. Whether they'll succeed or not, other people have tried before. It's a very difficult problem. I do think if they do succeed, that would be the moment, a bit like when Google suddenly found out how to make money with AdWords, when Google shifted to a whole new dimension of dominance in the market. And Facebook is already starting to really clean up in display advertising online. I mean, 25% of the US market is now Facebook. I mean, really chunky numbers now. So if they can actually start to become the default place where conversations for whole generations now happen within the walls, they're there. And but I don't necessarily have a problem with that, because, you know, I remember, you know, right back to sort of Six Degrees and, you know, early manifestations, someone I think will come along and do something better, and the generations will shift. A la MySpace, a la Bebo. I think with social networks, that's just inevitably the way. There's always something new, Twitter coming along or whatever. What I do think with this, though, is that the product needs to be good, because they're trying to solve a really difficult problem. They're trying to aggregate in one place synchronous and asynchronous messages, basically chat, synchronous conversation with effectively Facebook messages and email and text being essentially asynchronous. That's really hard UI problem, and good luck to them, frankly. I wish them luck, though.
Do you think, though, that this will, again, Tim Berners-Lee, he made this fantastic veiled criticism in an article suggesting large social networking sites, right? He didn't identify any particular one,
not MySpace anymore, is it?
Well, yeah, that are walling off information posted by their users from the rest of the web is a threat to his invention. And do you, given the conversation that we had moments ago, do you think that this is the case?
Well, the difference is no one's stopping you setting up a competitor to Facebook. I do think when you get to a point a la Google where you've got 90% of market share, which they do, Google has for search in the UK, you've got a problem. But, you know, Facebook's not quite at that level of being a complete attention sink. I mean, already my son is getting a bit sniffy, age 13, a little bit sniffy about Facebook. Whereas my daughter, 11, thinks it's the business. I won't let her use it, of course. And so, you know, the circle turns. And I'm nowhere near as worried about Facebook's potential dominance, given the level playing field, as long as the level playing field of a truly neutral net still exists for competitors to compete with it.
I think the problem that needs to be cracked for the internet is one that it is not in Facebook's interest to crack, which is, it's related to what Tom introduced us to, actually, but I'm reading Hamlet's Blackberry at the moment, which is about how you balance your life and how you need to be disconnected to process the information you get when you're connected. And what needs to happen with email and SMS and chat is that we develop a system that is just more realistic and more usable and more fair on us and our attention spans and the balance we need to keep with our real lives. We need very, very advanced, sophisticated ways, mechanical ways of processing the information that we've got in front of us. I mean, this is probably years off, but if what Facebook have come up with here is a hub, one central place for all these things, and from that you could then work out which of those really are the most important, which really need to be interruptive, and which you could come back to later, then that is starting to get somewhere very interesting. But it's probably still a very long way off. I'm just generally impatient, I think. But they are looking at voice and IMAP development for this, which will get really interesting.
I think one thing is really interesting is that a lot of the debate online has been, has Facebook done email? Whereas I think for a lot of Facebook users, they don't give a damn about email.
Yeah.
I'm much more interested in text integration. Yeah. I mean, my kids don't use email at all. Mm. I got them lovely domain names when they were born, and they don't even want them.
Fascinating as we see the cycles turn, whether it is MySpace, Bebo, 6degrees, or in fact AOL, people sort of coming to hubs on the web. And of course, we will have more on this as it arises. Now, before we move on, campaigners are trying to raise enough money to buy the papers of Alan Turing. He was one of the code breakers during the Second World War, and his paperwork, including the foundation of modern digital computing and his pioneering work on artificial intelligence, the Turing test, yes, is up for auction at Christie's in London today. There is a worry that that the papers will be bought, kept in a private collection, and we will never be able to see them again. So there is a collection to raise money for Bletchley Park, the wartime home of the Codebreakers and now a museum, to buy and then exhibit the work. If you'd like to donate to keep the papers in the UK and available to the public, then do donate to the fund. You have to be quick because the auction is at 2 p.m. today. You'll have to find out how at justgiving.com/Turing-papers. That's justgiving.com/Turing-papers. And Jemima?
I met a lady after a Remembrance Day ceremony who was wearing a medal and said it was for her work at Bletchley Park, and we talked for a bit and I was a bit starstruck. But I tweeted about that, and then Bletchley Park asked if we could retweet about the Alan Turing papers. So definitely do. It's very important.
Well, we will be hopefully reporting from Bletchley Park in 2011. Author Stephen Johnson is a treasure trove of good ideas. Steeped in technology with a refreshing long view of how new and old tech affect all our lives, from video games and television to the infrastructures of the cities that we live in, the Brooklyn-based writer is therefore in an ideal position to tell us where good ideas come from, and of course how to foster them so that they grow into great innovations. Charles met with him recently on his UK book tour and asked whether the internet is encouraging or stifling an explosion of ideas. He began by asking why ideas crop up at the same time, and what is the reason for why this happens?
It's kind of an uncanny thing about the history of ideas and technology. It's sometimes called the multiple, where simultaneously separated by geography and social connection, people will invent pretty much the exact same thing. Joseph Priestley isolated oxygen for the first time, and basically two other people, more or less unconnected to him, isolated it as well at the same time. Sometimes people look at that and they say, well, it's just spooky, right? But in fact, what it really shows you is that certain kinds of ideas, certain kinds of solutions to problems only become kind of imaginable or thinkable at certain points of time, because ideas are cumulative. They build on top of other ideas. They build on technologies or perspectives on the world that make those investigations or those kind of innovations possible. So for instance, with Priestley, to isolate oxygen for the first time, you had to have just the basic understanding that the air was something worth studying in the first place. There was a whole long period of time where nobody even thought it was interesting to study the air because there didn't seem to be anything there. And then you also needed technology that enabled you had to have very accurate scales that could measure the very small differences in the weight of things when they burned, which and revealed things about the nature of oxygen and oxidation.
One of the things you talk about is the idea of the adjacent possible, that it's because you're sort of sitting beside you're sort of sitting in the field beside where these ideas are ready to be found that the people invent them.
Yeah, the adjacent possible is a term from the kind of complexity theorist scientist Stuart Kaufman. And Kaufman's idea, and interestingly, he thinks that this is true of biological systems as well as human cultural environments in the history of ideas. And his idea is that basically at any given moment of time in a system, whether it's life or human society, there's a set of kind of possible moves that are available to you in terms of change and innovation. It's a bit like a chessboard, right? In the middle of a chess game, there's a finite set of moves that you can make and a much larger set of moves that you can't make, right? And Kaufman's idea is that what happens in, you know,
in a sense, you can't invent a microwave oven in 1650, right? It's just not within the adjacent possible. But every time you expand the adjacent possible and you invent something new and you kind of open up a new door, that it expands the space of possibility for other people, so that by inventing this one thing, you can invent something else. You invent the internet, that makes it possible to invent the World Wide Web, which makes it possible to invent Twitter. And so there's a sense in which all of these ideas are really densely kind of connected to each other. And part of the challenge is not trying to push things too far or to kind of escape the bounds of the adjacent possible. In the book, I talk about Babbage, Charles Babbage, who effectively, you know, jumped 70 years ahead of the adjacent possible and invented, you know, a digital age computer in the middle of the industrial era. And it really he literally couldn't build it. But he also, the ideas were so far ahead of their time that they actually kind of died out. And a lot of his key concepts about how kind of computer architecture should be designed had to be independently rediscovered 70 years later when people actually started to build them.
The idea that people can leap forward that far, actually, this seems to knock that idea down.
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, on the other hand, it's not making a purely kind of relativistic argument. I mean, there might be 100 people on the entire planet who would be capable of inventing an atomic bomb at that particular point, instead of just one. And so that's still – that 100 is still a pretty exclusive club, right? And so, you know, it is helpful to be you know, both to come into the world with some kind of innate intelligence and then to have that intelligence – enhanced by your upbringing and all that stuff. So people are smarter than other people, are going to be more likely to have better ideas, whether it's from their nature or their nurture. But the point is that what they're capable of doing with that intelligence is absolutely constrained by their specific kind of moment in time and the conditions of possibility that surround them.
Is there a way of, you know, someone who's in technology now of being able to survey the landscape and say, well, this looks like somewhere where, you know, if you pushed a bit, then you can take it further. Or are there sort of maps towards how to find the good adjacent possible?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that, you know, whenever you start to see the beginnings of a new platform where people are starting to kind of build on top of it. So one platform that I've been involved with and I've thought a lot about is location. So I started this company Outside In a couple of years ago that maps hyperlocal media and neighborhood bloggers and things like that. And then simultaneously, Google had released the API for its Maps platform so that you could actually build these map mashups and things like that. And so you could see people starting to experiment with the map as a new kind of form. And so when you see these kind of two interesting developments that are related to each other, where there's a new kind of conversation or a new kind of, you know, programming that's starting to happen, and they fit together in an interesting way, like that's a really useful kind of tell that something is happening. Now, the other thing I'll say about that is the importance of having kind of multiple interests and being interested in kind of multiple fields and following lots of different seemingly unrelated hobbies and interests, because it's from the collision of all those different interests that you get interesting ideas. This is not the kind of political argument for diversity. It's not just that we're better off as a society if we, you know, are more tolerant of people who are different from us. And it's – that may well be true. I think it is true. But it's also the point that, you know, by surrounding ourselves with people who have different backgrounds and work in different fields, we actually on some level make ourselves smarter. We make ourselves more capable of having interesting ideas.
Stephen Johnson. His book, Where Good Ideas Come From, The Natural History of Innovation, is out now. And I also spoke with Stephen. You can read the rest of that interview in last Sunday's Observer New Review at observer.co.uk/review. That's all for this week's Tech Weekly. Thank you very much, Tom Loosemore, and to Jemima. Tom, now that you're a free agent, what are you up to?
Really enjoying not spending 12 hours a day in front of a computer. I've also been helping a little bit of help to Martha Lane Fox's review of Government Online, which is pretty imminent, I think. Hopefully that'll be out very soon.
And we had a couple of questions for you from Twitter. Jemima, you collected them.
We did, just when we said you were coming on the podcast. Somebody asked what's going on with DirectGov and what's going on with e-petitions as well, as a man close to the action.
What's going on with DirectGov? Well, DirectGov was part of the review. Martha and her team had a really, really good look at it, talked to lots of people. Does a very popular website, DirectGov, 30 million uniques. It's also cost a lot of money. But I think the most important thing to remember is that Martha's been looking at the whole of .gov.uk central government, because there are hundreds of websites there. And I'm not sure that the user comes first in many of those websites. So expect some fairly radical ideas.
I think that I was luckily one of the people that she spoke with about that, and they've got some really interesting plans afoot for centralizing a lot of that in order to make it easier for the user to consume it.
Well, there's centralizing generally is often a really bad thing, and then you kind of whole thing sort of grinds to a sort of overcomplicated dead end. But when you've got that level of, I'd go close to calling it chaos as far as the user's concerned, in terms of where the hell am I, what website am I on, hundreds of .gov.uk websites, thousands. I think there's a strong case for much more consistency, generally raising the bar, and I think that inevitably means some more centralisation.
And how about the e-petition site? Because this was quite popular with the public and not so with a lot of politicians, and you were part of the team that built that originally.
Well, I didn't do any of the hard work. I just sort of helped keep the crap off their heads, actually. Martha's not looked at e-petitions, despite what you might read in the press. That's entirely down to what Number 10 won on their website. I can understand, I've read the same as you have, that people in Number 10 might feel a bit uncomfortable about that. Personally, I think it provided quite a decent safety valve when government was trying to rush things through much too quickly, such as road pricing, thinking you can force it through. Whatever the merits, it was trying to do it too quickly. And, 1.6 million people signing a petition in a couple of weeks is a bit of a clue that something's amiss. Arguably, nowadays, you've got more social media that you can look at for those kind of, spikes of unhappiness. But it really is down to Number 10, how bold they're feeling.
I think one of the problems with that, one of the arguments against it, was that there really wasn't any action, even off the back of 1.6 million people signing a
petition. Well, they did stop road pricing in its tracks.
But it's a universally understood format, the petition. It was very simple and accessible, and has reached a scale now where it's useful and people know to go to that. And I don't think you need to be particularly web literate to understand how to use a petition. I think there's a real strength in that.
The counter argument quite strong as well, that we have a system of representative government, not direct government, and that the right format for those views are through your representative, your MP, and through Parliament, and then on to government, not directly to the Prime Minister. So I think it's a bit more nuanced than sometimes presented.
Very, very good point. Well, Jemima and our tech editor, Charles Arthur, will be stepping on a plane to Dublin in a couple of hours, where you guys will be meeting the top tech startups for next week's programme.
We are. We have a fantastically packed schedule of meetings and interviews, and then a meetup at the Eli Gastro Pub, I believe it is, at, I think, 6:30, but it's all on the website. Anyway, you will need to have signed up to come along, but we're really looking forward to it, and it could not be more timely.
Certainly not. Well, don't forget also to send us your tech highlights of the year and which tech trends we'll be seeing in 2011. That's guardian.co.uk/techweekly, or do get in touch on our new Facebook page, perhaps via a Facebook message, at www.facebook.com/techweekly, or on Twitter at GuardianTW. But that's all for now. I'm Alex Kratosky. The producer this week was Scott Cawley. Thank you very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.
Don't forget to start your free 14-day trial of audible.co.uk, and to download your free audiobook, head to guardian.co.uk/audible.